Well, I have been looking forward to this weekend so much. I want to welcome everybody in this room and everybody joining us by video in Mountain View and San Mateo and Video Cafe and the V. One update, I want to let you know what's going on this year on Christmas Eve. A lot of you might have seen or read the book Unbroken. It's the story of Louis Zamperini, and it's one of the most powerful stories of somebody's journey to Christ I have ever read. And so this year, for everybody who comes to the Christmas Eve service, we're actually going to give a copy of the book Unbroken. And then in January, we're going to do a follow-up series called Unbroken about that book. And so I think Christmas Eve and then the series coming out of that are going to have, you know, enormous spiritual potential. And that's not even the whole story. Come back next week. We'll tell you a little bit more about what's going to be going on. But it's going to be really, really cool. So we wanted to give you a kind of a heads up about that now. Be praying, thinking who you can invite, because it's going to be a great night. And now I want to say a few words about our guest this evening. Dallas, you can come on up. Dallas Willard has been on the faculty of USC in the philosophy department, where he serves as a professor of philosophy since about 1965, I think.
Okay.
And was formerly head of the philosophy department. You all know his academic credentials and the work that he's doing there, which is tremendously important. He is also, as a matter of fact, the most influential, in my opinion, thinker and writer about spiritual formation. How do people get formed and shaped by God in our day? He's written a number of books about this. He is scary smart. I've told some of you I never get in an argument with Dallas because I'm afraid he will prove that I don't exist. But his heart is better than his mind, as good as his mind is. And Dallas lives in the reality of the kingdom and presence of God like nobody else I know. And he has become a wonderful friend to our church. We had 2.5 hours with Dallas this morning with our staff. So if he's getting a little tired, bear with him, because he's 97 years old. And no, he's not really that old. But it was an incredibly rich time, and we're so grateful to have Dallas back again. Would you all welcome Dallas Willard?
Thank you, John. Thank you. Menlo Park Press is a bright spot in my map.
You know you are a part of this. In disproportional ways.
Well, thank you.
And now today we have real important matters to discuss.
Mm-hmm.
We asked folks to send in questions on this issue of pain and suffering in God. And it was very striking. You know, they're difficult issues to think about intellectually.
Mm-hmm.
But it got real clear real fast. These are not theoretical issues. And it was just heartbreaking to read a lot of the questions. Yeah. And I just want to say for everybody here, you know, this is not just a teaching session. It's not just a lecture hall. We're a church. And we want to hold each other up in prayer and ask God to bring healing as well as good thinking. And I just want to say for anybody where your heart is touched, a number of us are going to stick around afterwards, and I think Dallas may also, just to pray. And if you would like prayer for pain or to pray for somebody in your life, we would love to do that. Because we want to be a family of God for each other. We're going to have way too many questions to get into, and we may change up some, you know, through the various services. But I thought I'd start with this one. You know, the death of Steve Jobs has gotten a lot of attention, particularly in our world here recently.
Right.
And there's kind of a poignant episode early in his life in Walter Isaacson's biography of him. His parents wanted him to have a religious upbringing, so they took him to a Lutheran church most Sundays. That came to an end when he was 13. In July 1968, Life magazine published a shocking cover showing a pair of starving children in Biafra.
Hmm.
Jobs, 13 years old, took it to Sunday school and confronted the church's pastor.
Right.
If I raise my finger, he asked, will God know which one I'm going to raise before I do? The pastor answered, yes, God knows everything. Jobs then pulled out the Life cover and asked, well, does God know about this and what's going to happen to these children? And basically, he just got an answer of yes, without much more comment.
Mm-hmm.
And then it says Jobs announced he did not want to have anything to do with worshiping such a God, and he never went back to church. So I think I'd put the question like this. With so much pain and suffering in the world, how can you believe in a powerful and loving God?
He asked the right question. It's not surprising that the pastor or whoever was not ready to go into it. In many ways, we can start answering that question by going back to what you did when you said, tell the person next to you, I'm really glad to see you. Because there are two keys to understanding this, and one is how precious human beings are. And sometimes we just don't know how to do that. C.S. Lewis has that wonderful line in The Greater Weight of Glory where he says, the most holy thing you will see apart from the Blessed Sacrament, he was a high churchman then, is your neighbor. And that's the starting point in this issue of suffering. Now, that will drive you to a view of God that is big enough to understand how everything will be made right and good. Everything. But you have to have a very large view of God to do that. And that is the primary problem. Because actually, normally we don't have a big enough view of God to accept how precious our neighbor is. You've got to have some resources if you're going to take that on. And that has to come from a larger view of God than most people, frankly, have. Now, an intelligent 13-year-old child, that is an opportunity to begin a conversation with them. They're too smart to take a glib answer. And we need to respect that because there really are no glib answers to this sort of issue. And one of my primary concerns is that when I come to talk about it, whether it's at the university in a class or here or elsewhere, is that people will think there is some snappy answer. Well, you can begin with that, but you have to be able to affirm to people that the God who knows every sparrow that falls knows about every one of the 29,000 children who died today because they didn't have enough food. They were not taken care of. Preventable causes. And all of a sudden you realize God has to be incredibly great. But that's what our theology says anyway. And we have to bring it home. Our songs. Not all else is nothing to me except you are. We lift that up. But it has to be filled out in such a way that both for our personal pain and suffering and for the suffering that is in the world, we can honestly believe and act upon the principle that God will see to it that everything comes out right.
But can I ask you at that point, because when we think about 29,000 children dying every day, my first thought is not, God must be great.
Right.
My first thought is, where is God? Why doesn't he do something? Why does that happen? Why does he allow it to happen? Couldn't it be otherwise?
It could be otherwise, but you're really raising the question at that point is, how is God to step in and make it otherwise? Because the issue of pain and suffering always comes back to human responsibility. And that, again, can blow your mind, because you might think, how can a human be responsible for a tsunami? And the responsibility of humans under God is very great, and that's tied to how unbelievably precious each person is. So you have to have a bigger picture of what's going on in the world, and that has to be anchored at one end in the preciousness of human beings, and at the other end in the greatness of God. Now, we don't understand all of how that works, and that's why it is important for us to affirm and to live in a way that we can see the action of God and the action of human beings to relieve human suffering, and think about perhaps that's our calling on earth, is under God to do what we can to help with human suffering and pain. Now, see, if you take the turn away that Steve Jobs did, and it's understandable why he did, of course many people do, you're not done with the problem. Now the question is, what are you going to do about it? See, if there isn't a good and powerful God, then there's no problem of evil as we ordinarily stand it. There's no problem. The only problem is, what can we do about it? And that's a big and important problem. But if there's no God, the answer to the question why is simply, why not? Why shouldn't there be suffering? Why shouldn't there be pain? And so once you have confronted this issue, then the question is, what's your next step? And depending on how you respond to it will determine the course of your life.
You know, the kind of classical way that it gets put is, if God is all-loving, he wouldn't want people to suffer.
Right.
Is all-powerful, he could stop all suffering, and yet suffering still exists. So he must either not be fully loving or fully powerful.
Right.
How do we think
about that? Or
he doesn't exist, yeah.
Right.
And that's usually the
right
conclusion.
Now, this is the way the problem has been set up since antiquity. And it's right to set it up that way. The only issue, then, is understanding what his power means and what his love means. And, for example, if one thinks that his love means I will never suffer, well, then, of course, he doesn't love us. But then perhaps we can find the meaning of suffering in what God has in view for the world and for human beings in such a way that we can understand that suffering itself is not the evil. The amount of suffering, the cause of it, those are big issues. And you never escape the question of what is God going to do about it? And if you say, well, he is going to deal with it, then you have to have a large enough picture. So let me use what I often use in talking about this in all kinds of contexts, and that is the child now dying of starvation in Somalia. What happens to that child? So that brings you to the question, is that the end of the child? Or is there a future for the child? And I don't think you can deal with the issue of suffering and pain without taking into consideration a future beyond death. If there is a great God and people don't stop existing, then it's possible for God to make that child that dies of starvation in the arms of a suffering mother, it is possible to say that child will, in the presence of God, be thankful for his existence and know that it is good that he lived. But you have to, that's where the issue of the greatness of God comes in.
So having a frame that is either restricted to life on this earth for a few days or years, as opposed to an eternal frame,
right,
makes
a huge difference. David Hume, who is not ordinarily thought to be a friend of God, though I think he's mistreated a great deal, says
not
very
in our church.
Good.
It's a joke, but it wasn't funny at all.
No, well, I hope you, I can believe that of your church. But in any case, he says in his very famous writing on the Dialogues of Natural Religion, he simply says, if you have a big enough God, there's no problem with suffering. He will solve it. And now that's where the witness of the Christian on earth needs to stand out. You see, when Steve Jobs, or most children ask this question, by the way, very few miss that point. They need to have, first of all, an affirmation that God is good and that he's available. And then the questions that come out of that need to be dealt with honestly and in terms of the child's own experience. But it's the preciousness of human life and the greatness of God, on the other hand, that comes together gradually so that people can affirm, I still believe, I still believe. And if those aren't brought together, alternatively, you can say that any individual is kind of like a teeter-totter, and the more weight you put on the greatness of God, the more effectively you can deal with suffering. The more weight you put on the suffering, the less you will believe in the greatness of God. Now, you see, the Christian message comes into that context, and it is a message of suffering. That's the heart of it. And the suffering is central to the message, but it doesn't stand alone. Death is the doorway to resurrection. Suffering is redeemed in the presence of God.
How significant is it that, you know, in the scriptures we're told that Jesus, who is God made flesh, actually suffers and suffers on the cross? How significant is that idea that in Jesus God is suffering, and how unique is that to Christianity?
Well, first of all, it is unbelievably significant, because the idea that God suffers puts him right down in the middle of what we live through. And that's why, you know, we have the Lord's Supper. And many times we forget the significance. This is a broken body. What goes into breaking a body? This is shed blood. And this we do as a constant reminder of God's union with us in suffering. So that whatever we're suffering from, and I know that everyone here is dealing with suffering and pain in one way or another, whatever we're going through, this is the key. We go through it, God with us. God suffers with us. When we suffer, he suffers.
When we suffer.
When we suffer, God suffers. The events of the cross were designed to give us a place to be with God, not just to keep us out of it, but to give us a place to suffer death and resurrection beyond that. And so now, you have the natural way of thinking, which comes up with the dilemma, either God is all good or God and all powerful, or he's missing on one of those. And those are very tempting alternatives. And one has to think at length about what it does to accept one or another of those alternatives. And then there is the Christian affirmation that God is perfectly adequate to deal with anything, and that he will, in fact, care for all who suffer. And the way he cares for us in this life is to be with us. Well, you have the line from the 23rd Psalm. Yes, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil because you are with me. And it is God being with us in our suffering that makes it a place of glory and not just disappointment.
That makes suffering a place of
glory.
Lisa, another question. You know, in James it says, consider it pure joy, brothers and sisters,
right,
when you face trials of many kinds. Mm-hmm. Somebody wrote this, what I struggle with most is finding joy in the midst of pain and suffering, especially when it is emotional pain and stress that seem to be overtaking and overwhelming me. How do joy and pain relate to each other? I know I should not put on a false face of happiness, but I clearly lack an inner sense of joy when I feel pain. Anybody relate to that?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a very important practical question. And you have statements like Paul's statement when he's listing what he has lived through, which mm-hmm. was pretty rough. Mm-hmm. And one of the phrases there in 1 Corinthians 6, I think it is sorrowful yet always rejoicing. Mm. And joy is a pervasive sense of well-being. And you
say
want
that again.
Joy is a pervasive sense of well-being. Now, you can have joy when you're in pain. And you can have joy when something really hurtful has happened in your life. You can have joy. Joy is a background reality. In this respect, it's like love and peace. It isn't an action. And you can have that in the midst of sorrow. But that will depend on where your vision.
But yeah, it really does come back to a great, great God and then a vision of eternity that really is compelling.
Absolutely.
We can't get away from that, can we?
Absolutely right.
Leads to another question. This didn't come to us. This was actually written to Dear Abby yesterday. But it has to do with the afterlife. A woman wrote in, I'm a middle-aged woman who is Baptist by faith. I believe when I die, I will go to heaven. My problem is, if going to heaven means being reunited with my parents and other family members, then I don't want to go. The idea of spending eternity with them is more than I can stand, but I don't want to go to hell either. Any thoughts? So how should we think about heaven and the afterlife? We tend not to talk about that a lot, and a lot of times a lot of people have quite cartoon images. Don't have a lot of grown-up thought about that.
No, that's right.
And part of what you're saying is there's no way to understand the problem of suffering without an eternal perspective. It just doesn't compute.
Right.
So how should we think about that?
Well, to begin with a case like this, we want to understand that there will be plenty of room in heaven for you to avoid people you don't want to be.
A lot of people are saying amen right now in their hearts.
But the important thing is to understand that people will be and see differently in heaven. And they will not be attracted to making others miserable. And here you have a lot of that. And heaven is actually a wonderful place for people to live and work. And we'll be working in heaven, except work won't mean quite what we mean here. So we'll have plenty of wonderful things to do, and that will make getting along with others much easier.
Do you think about heaven much?
I think of it much, yes, indeed. And now, but for me, heaven is not later. Heaven is now. Heaven is where God is. He invites us into heaven. No.
Heaven and so is not later.
Yeah, Isaac, if you're going to heaven, go now. And that will just solve a lot of problems here.
You know. And how do you, like, practically, I mean, it sounds wonderful, but practically speaking, how do you pursue that? Because actually, I'll back up for a moment. I know when it comes to pain and suffering, you don't talk a lot about this, but you experienced loss at a quite young age. And so you had to come to grips with these things as a person way before you did as a philosopher. Could you tell a little bit about when you were growing up, what was that like, and then how did you pursue heaven now?
Well, my mother died when I was 2. And in those days, the children of a family where a parent died, especially both, in this case it was just my mother, were fundamentally parceled out among the relatives. And my relatives were good people. And I have no complaints about them at all. But you know, when you're a child in that position, you know that you don't belong. and you live with that. Now, I didn't even understand what was happening. It's only looking back that I can recognize what that meant. But one of the things that it did was it taught me at a very young age to call out and depend upon God. And I can't remember when I didn't do that. I was quite ignorant, and there were many things that I didn't know, and I was a moderately wicked young man for a period of my life. But God was with me.
Never thought about being moderately wicked. Is that?
You know, there are degrees. But in any case, you learn to invite God into your life. Now, from the point of view of the individual, that is the secret of living with suffering and with pain, is to learn how to live in the presence of God. And you do that by practicing turning your mind to God, keeping Him before your mind, and inviting Him into your life, and then watching for His action. And that's how we come to know that God is with us.
Can I give you a really difficult one?
Sure. A
lot of questions came from parents. You know, there's lots of aches in life. The ache of a parent for a child is one of the deepest.
Yes.
And one of the questions, it was just a single sentence. How does one make sense when their teenage son takes his life? How does one make sense when their teenage son takes his life?
Well, I will suggest some things to do. This is such a heartbreaking situation. But I say to people in this circumstance, remember your son with love and dwell on what was good in your son. Remember that your son is now in the hands of a God who knows him better than you did or anyone other than God knows. And God is going to do right by your son. The third thing I suggest is keep him alive in your actions. Act on his behalf in your life. What you do for what is good, say, this is for you and for me. And I think when one does that, you will begin to experience God's assurance that he cares and that he is making provision, both for your son and for you. That's clinging to God. And there is no intellectual solution to this issue. We don't have enough understanding. What we can do is act in faith in our dependence upon God, keeping our son in our mind. One thing you don't want to do with your son who commits suicide is try to put him away. You want to keep him dearly in your heart and in your mind. And you want to thank God for him. And you want to thank God that God is now in charge of your son. Now, everything I'm saying here comes back to this one point. You have to have a big enough God. And if you don't, you can't deal with evil. Whether it's the evil
of... If you don't, then really evil wins.
It wins, and it will sour you and make you not... You will turn your back on God. And then there's no hope to deal with evil. Because whatever your response is, you have to go on. It's now up to you. You still have to go on. Steve Jobs had to go on. Everyone has to go on. And depending on how you think about God's greatness and always the preciousness of human beings.
Maybe you could say a word to us as a congregation, as a community and a family. I remember, it's probably been maybe 15 years ago, when I was going through a very discouraging and depressed time, flying out to spend a day with you and Jane. Mm-hmm. And at the end of that day, you did something nobody has ever done. We were praying, you were praying, and you put your hand over my heart.
Yes.
And it was the warmest sensation. And I thought, we don't do that very often.
No.
And we live in a culture where so often people go through loss and we just want them to be okay.
No.
And I think about when Job went through his loss, his friends sat with him 7 mm-hmm. days in silence.
Right.
And, you know, we may say, I hope you're doing okay, but how can we become the kind of community where people who suffer pain and brokenness find healing?
Well, I think you were inspired with your word about, I'm glad to see you. And the first act of love is paying attention. And we want to pay attention to one another. And then how we are with people, like the laying on of hands. See, that's a basic New Testament reality, is laying on of hands. Our bodies are instruments of God's Spirit. And we need to, as Paul says, recognize that we're inhabited by the Spirit of God. And then we need to recognize that we can give that to other people. And sometimes when you're sitting with someone who has suffered a crushing experience and is suffering, the only thing you can really do is to send what is in you to them. And you have to be with them in a certain way to do that. And we have to have teaching and understanding that is, you can send your joy into another person. You can send your love. You can send your peace into another person. Because we are together under God, and God makes that happen. And as a congregation, I mean, you can't do it for everyone. There are too many people. But there should be a circle of those around you that minister to you and you minister to, in terms of bodily presence. Many times in suffering, there is nothing you can do except be with people. And just be, but that isn't nothing. That is incredibly important. You know, and but we think it, well, I should be able to do something to fix. No, you don't fix people that way.
Another question that came in, and this is such a huge topic. I'm glad we have more services because we'll get to more of them. But this person wrote, why do we feel so alone and forsaken when bad things happen to us through no fault of our own? How can we feel closer to God instead? And it touches on something larger. The Bible talks a number of times about suffering and spiritual growth, and that suffering can actually lead to spiritual mm-hmm. growth. So how do we pursue that? How do we try to use pain to grow spiritually? Because it doesn't happen automatically. Some people suffer, and their souls get worse.
It's really practically extremely important to understand this. How we respond to suffering when it happens depends upon how we have been living with God when we weren't suffering. How we experience suffering depends on how we are experiencing God when we're not suffering. We need to be walking in the presence, the interactive fellowship with God all the time. Then when suffering comes, we're not alone. We're already with someone. God is with us. And so we're not automatically shoved off in a corner, and sometimes people don't know what to do with us when we're suffering because they feel like they're supposed to fix us and they don't know how to fix us. And so they just kind of push us off. You know, Job's friends get a lot of static thrown at them. I tell you, it's not a simple thing to come and sit with someone in Job's position for several days. And actually, we're not very well set up for that nowadays. You don't know if you want someone to come and spend 9 days or 10 days. But we do need to know how to be with people. Mm-hmm. And that depends on, do we know how to be with God? See, Paul says, nothing can separate us from the love of God. Now, see, what does that mean? It doesn't mean anything if it's just a theory. What Paul is talking about is an actual interactive relationship with a person that's gone.
So how does suffering come into that? Should I start with big suffering or little suffering? If I have a loss, what do I do with that? You know, practically speaking, when suffering comes, how do I try to find God in it or grow through it?
You want to be in a position where you don't have to try to find God. You're already turned to God when the suffering comes. And that's what enables you then to count it all joy when you fall into all kinds of troubles, is because you know God is with you, and you know that this is going to be an occasion of verifying and proving that He will carry you through. That's why you are rejoicing over it when something happens. But see, if you're not already turned to God, you won't do that.
You talk occasionally about how there's kind of three primary ways that God grows us. One is through practices or spiritual disciplines. One is through the movement of the Spirit. Mm-hmm. But the third one is suffering.
Yes.
How does God use suffering to grow us?
He uses suffering to grow us by allowing our thoughts and our feelings, our habits, all of those to be more turned toward His presence in our lives. And His presence in our lives is the key to everything. And now, if we're not suffering, we tend to trust ourselves. So we are our presence in our lives. And it is once we have put ourselves in Christ's hands, then we're ready for whatever comes, and it will benefit us. See, the saying, all things work together for good, that's not for everyone. That's for people who love God and are called on His purpose. So if we want to be in a position of dealing with suffering, we don't wait until suffering comes. We are in a position already of union with God in our lives, so that when suffering and pain comes to us individually, we are already turned to God. And that allows us to have hope, because He will act in our lives and will transform us. And suffering generally is one of the most redemptive things that happens to people if they're turned to God. If they're not turned to God. See, that's where the preaching of the gospel and the holding up of Christ and the promise of heaven later, as well as His presence now in this, that's why it's so important that we do that. See, I feel for the teacher or pastor or whatever who spoke with Steve Jobs, because they had an opportunity to present a great God for a great person, and they didn't do it.
Well, we have to stop our time together now, which is painful, but we're so grateful for this time. Can we all thank Dallas for being here? Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. And I think to close the service, and this is just for us here, not folks in the video venues. You know, Dallas, as you look out over this congregation, there'll be some people where life is going pretty well, but pain is coming.
Yes.
And then people who have gone through or are going through in the middle right now, agony over a child.
Yes.
Or a very painful divorce, or right. Guilt.
All of these things here.
Yep, one of these things right here.
Mm-hmm.
Unemployment, wondering where God is, feeling all alone. And a blessing would be a really good thing. And could you just say a word about, because we want to be a place that gives blessing, could you just say a word about blessing, and then could we close this service by you giving a blessing to folks? And,
surely.
And then after that, we'll just be down here, and if you want prayer, we'd love to pray for you.
Hmm. We bless one another. That's one of the main things about fellowship, is blessing. And blessing means that we are willing what is good for another person from God. We are never adequate just ourselves to bless. And so we say, don't we, God bless you. And that is a way of bringing the goodness of God down upon another person. Do you know what it's like to receive that blessing? It's one of the greatest gifts of Christian fellowship, is to receive the blessing of those around us who love and know us and who allow us to bless them in return. Blessing comes from God, and it is abundantly present, but we have to carry it and speak it upon other people. Blessing is speaking the goodness of God upon other people. That's why we call it a benediction. A good word is what that means. And it brings the blessing of God on you. Perhaps we stand? Or
it's up to you.
Oh, let's we'll stand together. Now may the good word of God come into your heart and bring with it all of the goodness of God Himself, so that you will never be alone. And whatever the sorrow or pain that comes into your life, it will always be enveloped in the presence of God for you. The Lord bless you and keep you in the depths of your soul, so that whatever you go through, it will be joyful in the presence of God. Let it be done, dear Lord, to everyone here, especially to those who may be going through some special pain right now as we stand here before you. I'm going to ask you to send your Spirit into the pain. And in the midst of the pain, let hope spring up because you are with us. And I speak that to you now, that it might be with you now and forever. In the honor of Jesus, we say it. Amen.